Okay, go.
Good morning, diners and travelers and cheese lovers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I think this is a big deal, the annual American Cheese Society conference.
Listen up, listeners. If Ann says it's a big deal, it's a big deal.
And it
is. It's a double big deal.
How about 2,000 cheeses?
Yeah, it's a double hit because not only is it the national event of all national events in the world of cheese, it also happens to be coming to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania,
right,
our hometown, and helping to put it on the map.
Right.
So there.
And not only that, we're going to be talking to Nora Weiser, who's she's so accomplished. It's so nice to see a smart, capable woman running such an important organization.
You'll know that's true when you have a chance to hear how she's really on top of the event and everything to do with cheese.
Nora Weiser is the head of the American Cheese Society, and we already said that both my mother and Peter's mother's first name was Nora. So we were probably intended to talk.
we were intended to eat cheese.
And eat cheese. I'm not clear in my head, but I vaguely recall when Alison Hooper established the American Cheese Society. I'll refresh my mind on that.
Sure. Well, the association was actually founded way back in 1983 by a group of cheesemakers, some home cheesemakers, some artisan cheesemakers kind of just getting started. And it was founded at Cornell University, and the founder is Professor Frank Kozakowski, who is still quite well-remembered and regarded in the industry for some of the books that he put out about cheese and dairy product fermentation. So we are actually entering our 35th year at our conference in Pittsburgh, and certainly have grown right alongside the industry and folks like Alison Hooper at Vermont Creamery and, you know, who were early pioneers in bringing goat cheese to the country, made here and based on some of the more traditional cheese-making methods. So Americans are loving it, and they want to buy local, and it's kind of a great trend to see.
It's exploded. I mean, literally exploded.
Yeah.
Well, you already mentioned what we're really talking about is this annual conference, which has grown to a huge operation, and this year is taking place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And how many do you expect to be coming?
Well, we have about 1,400 attendees and about 2,000 cheeses, so you've got to love an event where the cheeses outnumber the people.
Do we need to taste all 2,000 cheeses?
If you can do it, then you should get an award on your own. But it's great to try all of these unique cheeses, and we move around the country every year in part because we want to give cheesemakers everywhere access, and some of the smaller producers just can't get away to travel, you know, across the country every year. That's kind of why we move around.
Yeah, my great uncle was a dairy farmer, and he never got out.
It's amazing. It's a very difficult, you know, takes a lot of passion and resolve, and you know, we have a category of producers that we call our farmstead cheesemakers, and they are both dairy farmer and cheesemaker right on the same property. So that is, I don't know how you would ever get a break, because when a cow wants to be milked, a cow needs to be milked.
Well, there is a new thing I was just reading about, because Uncle Frank, I know, had to be there twice a day for this milking routine, but they have a robot now and a milking shed. And so the robot can stand there, and when the cow wants to be milked, she comes in and gets milked by the robot. And they've estimated it's generally about 4 times a day and is at least double the quantity of milk that they got otherwise.
Yeah, there's so many things that they're doing. I mean, first on that farming side, but also on the cheesemaking side. You know, I've seen robots that flip over 100-pound wheels of cheese and put them right back on the shelf, you know, to go through their aging process.
Wow. Okay, back to the conference. It's not just one thing. I mean, there are educational components, there's socializing components, there's the award component, which is a big thing. Tell me what the highlights of this conference are.
Sure. Well, for professionals in the industry, I would say some of the highlights are the very focused education, which might be on microbiology of cheese rinds or different new trends in, you know, humane animal welfare. And for them also, of course, the award ceremony is a big deal. For the public, the cheese-loving public, we hold a festival of cheese, which if anyone has never seen this, it's quite something. All of the cheeses from our competition are on display and available for tasting with their awards on them. People can go around the room to different categories. You'll see a cheddar table, and there will be hundreds of cheddars, ranging from the more familiar, you know, kind of orange block cheddar to the bandaged wrap aged goat cheddar. And around that big hall at the convention center with all of the cheese, we have other purveyors of specialty foods who are providing samples of charcuterie and crackers and jams and ciders and beers. And it's a food lover's kind of heaven. And that is on Saturday, July 28th at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center. Information on all of this, or if people want to purchase tickets, is on our website, which is www.cheesesociety.org.
Great.
And it is open to members of the general public. All you need to do is buy a ticket.
Correct. You just need to buy a ticket. And if you don't want to buy a ticket, we also seek out cheese-loving volunteers.
Oh, yes.
We have hundreds of local volunteers to help us get that festival ready. So there are a lot of opportunities, again, on our website under our conference tab. If people go to the volunteer section, they'll see all kinds of opportunities, whether it be helping us receive cheese when it's coming in, assisting our judges by making sure they're getting their cheeses exactly at the right time for their judging process, and then, of course, preparing for our big festival.
Now, you started telling me before we turned on the recorder here about the process of receiving 2,000 different cheeses. Could you run through that for us?
Sure. So our process starts basically on Friday, July 20th. All of the cheeses are shipped to us that earlier in that week. Many of them are shipped overnight, and they all arrive on Friday, July 20th at the convention center.
That's amazing.
We have a room full of volunteers and our team and some committees, and they have it down to a science. They are marking the packages and moving the cheeses and checking the temperatures and getting them onto the right racks and trays.
Oh, wow.
And right into our refrigerated 55-foot trailer trucks, of which we have five. And then the next day on Saturday, July 21st, we hold our cheese curd judging. So as you know, cheese curds need to be fresh and squeaky, and cheesemakers are very particular about that. So those cheeses get judged the very next day. So, you know, they're basically made on Thursday, overnighted to us, received, tracked, and then judged on Saturday.
Now, can you give us some idea of which cheeses are the fresh curds?
I'm talking about the actual curds themselves. In many parts of the country, if you think of the Midwest, for example, cheese curds are very popular, and they're just the very fresh curds before those curds are turned into any cheese.
Oh,
they're delicious. They're squeaky. They're salty, and they're very addictive. And people make all kinds of different flavors now. You know, everything from more traditional garlic and herb curds to I think there are some with ghost pepper. You want to eat those last?
Yeah, I would say.
And then our next step is on Monday and Tuesday, which is the 23rd and 24th of July. Our judges then judge every cheese those 2 days. So what that entails, we have 44 judges, so it's pairs of two, so 22 pairs of two judges. Each group, they have one technical judge, which is an expert in dairy grading and assessing flaws in the cheeses that are technical in nature, and then an aesthetic judge, which makes our competition unique because those aesthetic judges look for the positive attributes in the cheese and the qualities that you would look for in that specific type of cheese. So the points are deducted for flaws that are technical, and the points are added for positive aesthetic attributes.
How hard is it to find that many experts?
You know, it's actually not as hard as it once was. The technical judges often come out of universities, dairy programs. Some of them are international judges. And then the aesthetic judges, we have more and more of them, in part because we have we launched a certification about 6 years ago for certified cheese professionals. And these are people who, it's not unlike a sommelier program, but these are people, we now have over 900 who are certified, who have an expansive knowledge of everything from the cheese make process until that cheese reaches the end consumer.
Wow.
And so that has been a great pool of very talented experts. And then this year in Pittsburgh, we're actually launching a brand new certification, which will be a certified cheese sensory evaluator.
Oh, that's the Australian guy.
Well, we do have an Australian judge, Russell Smith, who might be, that might be who you're thinking of, but we're doing a an actual certification exam has been built and designed, and people are sitting for the first time for that exam in Pittsburgh. And that is, it's called the TASTE test, and that is just a clever acronym for the Technical Aesthetic Sensory Tasting Evaluation Test.
What does that mean? I mean, the sensory.
So it's a practical exam. So whereas the Certified Cheese Professional is a written exam, this is a practical exam. There will be 12 cheeses, and each cheese has a very unique score sheet. And the test takers will need to evaluate each cheese and identify flaws and attributes based on what would be expected of that category of cheese. Those cheeses are simultaneously being judged by our technical and aesthetic expert judges. So they'll be kind of judged against that as the norm. In addition, there will be samples of single attribute milks. So that is where a taste or flavor profile is infused into the milk, and they have to be smelled and or tasted to identify. It can be things like asparagus, mushroom, anything, you know, barnyard, whatever it might be, they identify. And those who, you know, hit a certain level of expertise will then be recipients of this designation of a certified cheese sensory evaluator. So it's a great way to take something that can be very objective and create a very subjective and create a very objective standardized language around it. You know, so people say, when I taste this, I need to describe it as this so that I can have clear communication, whether you're a cheese maker or buyer or seller, even a customer.
Now, I have a two-part question.
Sure.
One of the things that we've discovered in our interviewing of cheese professionals across the country, and we talked to quite a lot of them, is that they've experienced in the last several years absolutely phenomenal success in the, what people I guess consider the World Championships of Cheese, which takes place in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering in a second if you'd like to comment on why it is that American cheeses have become so successful. But I had a different side of the question, which is, are there cheeses from the rest of the world part of your conference, or do you deliberately keep them out?
So we have not built a wall to keep them out, but we do focus on North American-made cheeses. We have special areas at our conference where Gruyere and Comté and the other international producers can have their product, because, of course, cheese is wonderful for everyone to learn about, and we learn so much from our European colleagues. But our competition is strictly for North American cheeses made from North American milk sources. So our soft-ripened category, we have a great number of Quebec cheesemakers who enter. We have a buffalo cheesemaker from Colombia that enters. So we're really focused on that area as far as our judging and competition. In our educational programs, we often have cheeses from other parts of the world because we're trying to learn about cheese. And then we also have we call them our networking salons, where these other international cheese groups can sample and teach our audience about their cheeses as well. Because, you know, many of these attendees might be buyers or retailers who are looking for cheeses from everywhere.
Well, so many of the American cheeses now, the smaller artisanal, seem to be bought up by larger global entities, like they just sold Rogue Creamery.
Yes, to Savencia. Yes, so what we've seen is similar to what, I mean, I draw many parallels to the craft beer industry. We're not nearly that large.
Right.
But, you know, these small microbreweries get started, they grow, they have success, and then they get consolidated into larger companies. And, you know, I think that's a testament to the growth of the industry, that it has hit that point where a lot of these producers are now attractive to investors and to larger cheese entities who are saying, oh, people are interested in these cheeses.
Why are we doing so well, then, do you think?
That is a good question. Well, I think there's also, there are just more and more people getting into it. And while we hear a lot about the successes and the growth, there are also a lot of people who give it their best shot and just simply cannot do it. And I think it's just a challenge. It could be where they're located. It could be the milk prices. It could be whether or not they have their own herds. It's a very challenging industry. People like to say, if you want to make a small fortune in cheese, start with a large fortune. So it's a very challenging industry.
I always thought that was wine. And
it's cheese, it's wine, it's all of those things, I think.
That brings me to the next question, which is, you have pairings of beer and cider with cheese, but not wine. Why?
We have done a lot of pairings with wine. Everything kind of comes in waves. And while I think it's going to loop back to wine eventually, because I love wine with cheese, I think it's just, especially for kind of younger audiences, they're looking for what's new and different. We've also had cheese paired with spirits. I went to a session once. It was 9 o'clock in the morning, and they gave me 6 whiskeys to try with cheese. It was a long day, but a wonderful day. So I think it's more, especially since this is a professional audience that has been through a lot of different trainings and educational types, they've done cheese and wine, you know, so it's kind of the what's next. So our sessions tend to focus on kind of the upcoming trends, and I think wine and cheese being so traditional is maybe not among that at the moment. But it does ebb and flow. We know what is popular.
Now, before the conference starts, you have these tours to showcase aspects of the city.
True.
I wonder why they all start at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, we have a busy schedule for our attendees. So, you know, we have things going on later in the day for those tours, so people want to get back to do the receptions. And we have an event, which is actually a fundraiser for the American Cheese Education Foundation. It's kind of a sister charitable group. And they it's called our annual Cheese Crawl. And it includes just a walking tour in downtown Pittsburgh near the convention center to about 4 different pubs. And at each stop, there are regional cheesemakers doing samplings of their cheeses. And you can try those with different beers and ciders and wine, if you want, at the bars. So people like to get back and start socializing, as you mentioned, and networking and jumping right into conference. Well, plus, we have a lot of farmers, right? So if they're not doing something by 6 a.m., they're bored.
Oh, really?
Funny. Well, sweetheart, should we go over the vital information before we close?
Well, I wanted to point out that what we're going to be doing is, did we say enough about the concurrent educational sessions during the conference? I'm not sure, but I wanted to say that we are going to be interviewing in shows between now and when we launch this conference, interviewing both local cheesemakers and national cheesemakers. And then we will also be at the conference interviewing various cheesemakers. And by then, I think we'll know who the winners are and we'll be able to interview them, right?
Yes, and we actually have a media briefing on that Saturday morning, July 28th, where the 3 best of show winners will be available for photos and questions and interviews and all of that. So,
okay, are we all going to get information about that?
All of that information will go out, yep.
Okay. You know, it's very complicated, all the different aspects of this.
I know. There are a lot of moving parts and a lot going on, but the main thing to remember, it's cheese.
Right.
So you can't go wrong no matter what you participate in.
Right. I just wanted to say this is a big event every year, and it's a big event this year for Pittsburgh, and listeners should expect to be hearing a great deal about cheese between now and the conference.
We hope so.
Right. Did you have anything you wanted to ask?
No. Let's run the website again.
Oh, yeah, the website again is?
Sure, it's www.cheesesociety.org, and people will see tabs across the top, and one of them says conference, and all of the information is available there about volunteering. You can click through to purchase a ticket to the Festival of Cheese. You can read the entire schedule. You can register. You can join our organization. So everything is there.
Well, Nora, you're doing a great job, and I really will take this opportunity to congratulate you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and I'm excited.
Great. Well, we look forward to meeting you and being in Pittsburgh. It's just a great city for us. Lots of great food happening and very welcoming audience. So we're looking forward to it.
Well, good. Well, we will see you then.
Thank you so much to both of you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so now you know, right?
Yeah.
Nora's right on top of it, you may be sure. And we're going to be going on to a slightly different subject right after the break, but don't go away because we won't be long.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Here's a hint. What goes with cheese?
Sometimes.
Say wine, and you're talking, what we're talking to Kathleen Burchett about, her cheeky, which goes with, I don't know, what was that I said before about the book?
What are you doing here? You're lost.
But Kathleen wrote this book called The Wine Lovers of Prentons. Apprentice that you're going to just love. It takes all the stiff junk away and gives you real information.
Put this away. and lost her marbles this morning. honestly, this is a really worthwhile book. It's a really worthwhile subject. We hope you'll enjoy.
Kathleen Burchett, The Wine Lover's Apprentice, is your book, which I said was a very sassy book, and you liked that. Why?
I love that description, because it's not meant to be stuffy. It's meant to kind of tweak things a little bit, and that one word that you've come up with just captures it beautifully.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Well, there's another way of describing it, which puts it in perspective as well, because I think people who like wine and you're obviously one of them, and Anne's another one, and I'm a third of those, at least, like big books about wine. There's no question. You enjoy a big book about wine, just like we do. But even happier is a small book about wine. And the Wine Lover's Apprentice qualifies.
It does. You know what? I love that it's so tiny, because you can just stick it into your pocketbook or your briefcase, and really have it along as a reference tool, which is the best part.
Well, you distill everything down as well. I mean, so that you don't have to grope around trying to figure out what all this stuff means. You know, like, I never knew that bricks referred to a person. I mean, I know it's sugar, but I'm saying I didn't know it was discovered by a person.
No, it's like, right. It's like bird's eye. Frozen peas.
Frozen peas, right. Bird's eye. You know, that was a person, too.
It was invented by Mr. Clarence Birdseye.
It's true.
So anyway, this book pretends that it has words of wisdom for would-by enophiles. And it says, you'll know your grapes, navigate a wine shop, conquer a wine list, serve, sip, and store wine, and get your wine geek on. That's all on the front cover. On the back cover, Kath, it says you're a fine wine concierge. Now, what the hell is one of those?
So, fine wine concierge is kind of something that I created. to help people with whatever they need in terms of wine. So I teach classes both in stores and in people's homes. I help people buy wine or sell wine that's in their cellars. I help people organize their wine cellars. I've advised people on starting a wine collection. So it's kind of whatever my clients need relating to wine that I do. And it's really the classes that kind of inspired this book because I had some students who were just wonderful and inquisitive, and that's kind of the fun part of teaching the classes, this back and forth. And they would ask these great questions, and they would really want to drill down. And it finally kind of occurred to me, I can put this in a book that really breaks things down for people, because nobody cares that you can smell, you know, a Meyer lemon that was picked by a left-hander on a dewy morning. I mean, it's great if you can identify that, but most of us don't really need that level of knowledge.
I suspect that you must have been sitting into our last blind wine tasting class.
Some people get a little bit crazy, but if you don't know where to start with wine, that's so intimidating.
No, we're just on our way to being intimidated by the wine. And it's interesting. The very first paragraph has a section about why wine gives you a headache, which is an awful, which suggests, people would suggest it's probably a very good place to start.
It's maybe not the best place to start because it sounds so negative.
We were out with a group of fellow wine drinkers on Saturday, and on Sunday, one of them said, "I'm drinking water today."
Oh dear, he had a little too much wine.
is there such a thing? I don't know about that.
It's very individual. Let's say that.
But
okay.
But you even have an acronym called RWH, standing for red wine headache, and you say that doesn't even really exist.
I drink wine. That's my favorite wine. I drink red wine all the time. I never get headaches.
I'm not a medical doctor, but it seems like different people have so many different reactions to wine. Some people get headaches, some don't. Sometimes it's red wine, sometimes it's white wine. It's European wine, it's American wine. So it's really just something hard to pin down.
Well, Kathleen, let me tell you that I feel sorry for today's chefs, because it's not just wine. Everybody has an issue with food. I mean, it's always classified as an allergy, which is a lie. I don't know anybody who has an allergy to garlic. But they will say they do because they don't like garlic. So
right.
That then becomes an allergy.
Well, okay, so let's give people an idea of the wisdom they're going to find here. So I'm looking at a short paragraph called "Legs, Do You Know How to Use Them?" and this is not what one would expect. Can you explain?
Yep, absolutely. So you've seen probably in, you know, TV shows, Frasier's one that comes to mind, where people are swirling the glass and looking and making grand pronouncements about the wine. And legs are something you can see. You kind of have to look through the glass to the far side, if you can kind of picture that. And sometimes you'll see kind of the wine running down in little streams. And those are what's referred to as legs, because I guess it looks a little bit like legs. And people used to think that legs were a sign of quality, that if you had a good wine, you were going to have these nice, kind of thick, rich legs running down. And really, it's been realized that it has nothing to do with quality. And it really has everything to do with either how much sugar is in a wine, because if you notice with a sweeter dessert wine, you get sort of thicker legs, and they sort of take their time running down the side of the glass, or from a very warm climate or vintage, because you have that extra heat and extra alcohol that went into the wine, you also get sort of a thicker leg running down. A wine from a cool climate isn't going to show that as much. And really, that's all it tells you.
It also might be a dirty glass.
you might see that dirt as you're looking through it, for sure.
Now let's go on to the next one. This is just on the very next page. Just give you an idea how much information is packed into here. Talk to us a little bit about terroir.
Terroir. So it's this French notion that a wine tastes like the place where it's from, which means that the soil that it's in, that the climate, whether it was sunny or rainy or if you had hail, if it's breezy, that all of that goes into, that you can taste it all in the glass, so that you do have that person who can taste the Meyer lemon picked by a left-hander. In theory, you should be able to tell that it's a French wine from a particular region, you know, in this kind of soil, from the flavors that you get in the wine. There's some people who say, you know, that's nothing, that's just a marketing thing, people have made it up. But it's kind of like the red wine headache. You can't really prove it or disprove it. So let's just say it does exist and that wines do kind of taste like their place, which I think anybody who's lined up six Chardonnays or six Cabernets from different areas and tasted them notices that they don't all taste the same. So there's got to be something to it.
Oh, our wine tasting group of snobs, I mean, they really obviously had drunk a lot of wine over the years and had excellent memories because they could even pinpoint which side of the creek.
Well, let's come back to the book now. Now, the next subject covered requires a full 3 pages, and that's a primer, if you like, on the main red and white grapes that you're going to encounter if you're drinking fine wine.
Yes. So it covers, you know, sort of Cabernet and Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and Merlot, but it gets into some slightly more obscure, but ones that you should really know about, grapes like Cabernet Franc or Riesling, that really sort of deserve a place in your wine knowledge.
And this isn't just a sort of a pat on the back for all wine grapes, because you have a little dig at a particular white wine, which I hate too.
Oh dear, which one is that? I have to go to the page now.
The Pinot Grigio.
Oh, Pinot Grigio. You know what? Pinot Grigio.
The horrible Santa Margarita, which sells for an outrageous price and it tastes disgusting.
Well, Santa Margarita started out as a $6 bottle, and now it's $30, and they have really, really good marketing.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of passion in the book. You know, Pinot Grigio gets a bad rap because most of it is, you know, not great. It's sort of hastily crafted, and it, you know, sort of rides this wave for people who don't really know a lot about wine, but they know that they like Pinot Grigio. We'll call it a gateway wine. You know, it sort of gets people into the door of drinking wine. But when you find a good one, you know, with a producer who's taken the time to really care about the grape and what it can bring, it's really fantastic. So you just have to kind of seek out the good ones.
So what do you think about Randall Graham trying to invent a whole new grape?
Oh. Well, you know what? I think people kind of do that all the time. You know, you cross, people do grape crossings, and there are different clones, you know, of the grapes, because people do want to bring out a particular feature of a grape, mm-hmm. or maybe suppress one, maybe make it with a thicker skin or resistant to a particular bug. So I don't mind that he's tweaking around with it so much.
Yeah, well, he's not grafting them. He's actually trying to crossbreed.
Yeah, but it's really funny. We had a bottle somebody brought to our group on Saturday.
Yeah.
And it was called a Perfect Claret.
Okay.
And I looked on the back label, and there is Bonnie Doon Vineyard.
It's funny.
So,
yeah.
So you never quite know what he's going to do next. Now, let's recognize one of the value propositions about this book, because it's got a couple of pages and a map that, mm-hmm. that shows you where are the wine regions in these various countries, so that you can either pretend to be an expert or at least know more than you do if you haven't had a chance to do that.
You know, it's always good to kind of fix the place in your mind, because, you know, with that notion of terroir and with the idea of where a wine is from, it really does inform. And one of the things that I aim to do in the book is to empower people to be able to look at a bottle and say, oh, this is probably going to taste like X,
yeah,
because it's from a warmer climate, or the vineyards are closer to an ocean or you know, a bay or a river or whatever. Those factors do influence a little bit where a wine grows. So I think being able to visualize it helps to understand where a wine's style comes from.
Yeah, I would never, ever have expected to encounter a drinkable English wine, I must say. And they actually have decent...
I'm offended by
that. Oh, I'm sorry.
But you know what they're coming up with in England right now?
Champagne.
Is sparkling wine.
Yeah.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Some truly
so we're Peter's whole family's there, so we're back and forth a lot.
Yeah, and we drink
it took me a lot
we drink
of
foreign, we drink foreign wines, but we drink home wine some of the time too. But there are a couple of other things I wanted to mention where there is wisdom that is worth listening to. One is how to deal with a sommelier, and the second is how to deal with a person in a wine shop who's trying to sell you wine. So that,
yeah.
You have a couple of big tips on those that will get people off on the right track.
Well, in not every restaurant has a sommelier, obviously. That tends to be, you know, sort of the more mid-range to the higher-end restaurants. But sommeliers really are your friend. But it can be intimidating to talk to them. But the good ones won't be intimidating for you. The good ones won't be snobby. They get such a joy out of helping you uncover the exact right wine that you want. So don't be afraid, you know, if you see a wine in your price point, you know, to point to it and say, well, I was kind of looking at this wine, but I want something that's fruitier or earthy or full, or I was thinking maybe a Pinot Noir. And a good sommelier is going to kind of pick up on that price point without saying anything and then be able to recommend things that are within your budget based on, you know, what you've pointed to, which is, you know, very savvy of them to be able to pay attention that way.
Now, when we still were willing to go to Babbo.
Oh, no.
David Lynch actually waited on us. David was, of course, the sommelier at Babbo, but and decided he was our waiter. and he never let on.
No, he was wonderful.
Right?
But he did exactly what you just described.
Yeah, a good sommelier is so discreet. It's really lovely.
But the outcome was fascinating because he sold us a wine that was $10 a bottle less than the one we were thinking about buying.
Good for him.
So there is wisdom in sommeliers if you tap in and you show you're interested. And the next one, which is a different approach altogether, you suggest, which is how to get to know your local wine shop and how to make sure that they advise you on the things that you're going to enjoy.
Yes. Well, one of the hardest things I found for people is to be able to describe what they like in a wine, which is, you know, sort of unfortunately a key when you're in a wine store to getting help sometimes. You know, wine stores, they may have, you know, some staff who love wine and they know wine and they get it. Other people might just be there for a paycheck, so not everybody's, you know, so lucky. But when you're walking into a store, one of the best pieces of wisdom is don't buy the first wine you see, because there are all sorts of tiers and regulations and distributors and importers and everybody, you know, who's getting their piece of the wine pie, if there's such a thing. So when you walk in and you see there's a big case of Shiraz on sale for $8.99, and you might think, wow, $8.99, this must be a great wine. But what might have happened is the store had to buy maybe 25 cases of that wine in order to get something that's much more rare. Well, we'll sell you, you know, 2 cases of this if you buy 25 cases of that.
Exactly.
So they got 25 cases to get rid of. And that doesn't mean it's a bad wine, but it may not be the right one for you. So, you know, you sort of take the knowledge that you have when you go into a wine store, from the knowledge from the book on how to read a label and kind of understand, you know, what's going on in the bottle. Do you want something fruitier? Go to California if you're looking for something a little bit earthier. You know, go to Europe if you're having Italian food, get an Italian wine, and to sort of take that knowledge and look at a shelf of wines and be able to pick something that's going to be good and right for what you're drinking it with.
Do you follow golf?
No.
Okay, no. I was going to use a golf analogy for a second. Our listeners will understand because Tiger Woods is almost back, so it's getting really exciting again.
Okay, I've heard of Tiger Woods, with you so far.
But the guys on the tour, if you've seen it at all, you would have noticed they have big fat lumps in their back right or left hip, depending on whether they're right or left-handed. And in that is a book with all the information they've gathered about this particular golf course.
Ah.
Well, I can picture wine lovers equipping themselves the same way with your book.
That would be amazing. Uh-huh. Everybody have a copy in their back pocket.
In their back pockets, so they can refer to it when they can't quite decide what to do.
Yes.
You are to be congratulated, Kathleen, on
who was it? I think Oscar Wilde said, brevity is the soul of wit. You did it, gal. You absolutely did it. The wine lover's apprentice belongs in your back pocket, listeners, if you are interested in the game of wine. So thank you so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom today. And we wish you continued success, and we'll welcome you back, I'm sure.
Thank you both, Anne and Peter. It's been a delight chatting with you, and I hope to be back.
Great. Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, so if we had a classy segment about wine, we should follow it up with a...
Cheeky.
And sassy. That too. We should close with a man who's on a lifetime pursuit. John Tebow, Steeler fans, not Tim Tebow. This man decided to dedicate himself to the bars and dives of New York City, which he calls home. And it's really quite an amazing story and a fascinating subject that I'm sure you're going to be interested in. You're going to want to come back and listen to John time after time.
You know, our next guest, John Tebow, I could talk to about a gazillion different subjects, but we're going to try to focus on this charming book that he's just produced called Bars, Taverns, and Dives, New Yorkers Love. And you love too, but even though you're not a native New Yorker, you hail from the Midwest, right, John?
Yeah, that's right. I came from Michigan.
Yeah, which is my old alma mater, as we were just saying.
Yep, and I've been in New York for about 12 years now.
Uh-huh. And you studied to be a member of the gloomy profession, right?
Yeah, that's right. I studied economics. I got my bachelor's in economics back at the U of M.
There you go. But then at some point in your life, you decided to do something else, which was a real surprise.
And I still don't understand how you did that. How did you suddenly just sort of edge your way from economics into art?
Well, that's a good question. I got a job right out of college. I got a job in marketing in Chicago, and it didn't suit me. It was a desk job. There was a commute involved. I'm not a huge fan of commuting, especially by car, in a big city. And I'd always been drawing and doing a few jobs here and there with illustration throughout my life. And then just thought I'd go full force with it and started designing T-shirts and printing them through the silkscreen process. And I started doing more illustrations and learning how to paint. And I started an alternative comic book with a fella in Chicago that was a lot of fun. And that spread to Ann Arbor as well.
And John swears that he never played quarterback for the Florida Gators.
Yeah, totally different Tebow.
Or anything like that. But the book, should we call it just the book? Bars, Taverns, and Dives. I mean, that must have been just sort of out of the blue. I mean, were you drinking at the time you decided to do it?
I think that would be a good excuse. It turned out to be such a much larger job than I thought it would be. I'd like to say I was drinking when I said yes to it. An outgrowth of an art project. It's an ongoing art project, really, and it's something I started a few years ago to draw my favorite bars of Brooklyn. I just drew my six favorite bars in Brooklyn, and I made prints out of them and showed them a couple of places, and somebody said, well, I think that could be a book, and I talked to an agent, and she thought so, and she got me a deal with the wonderful Rizzoli Publishing.
And they're great, aren't they? They're a great publisher.
They're just wonderful art books. Yeah, they do a really good job.
But let's
let's turn our attention.
Yeah, Peter's interested in the actual subjects here.
Yes,
he wants to talk about the bars.
It's a total quality work here, and this is a. It may not be a girl's book, but it's certainly a guy's book.
What do you mean it's not a girl's book? I mean, the drawings are absolutely luscious. I love them.
And
just
to give you an idea, this is not just a little book with six pictures of John's favorite bars. I was particularly interested in the little section you have on the page about ballast.
Yeah. Yes.
This is clearly advice from a veteran. why don't you let our listeners know about ballast?
I surely needed it during the research of this book. As you said, it started out with six bars that I had drawn, and when my agent Meg Thompson said they wanted 50 bars, I thought, well, maybe we would do two dozen, but they said, nope, we want 50 bars from all five boroughs. And I don't really know everywhere in New York. New York's so sprawling. How can you know everywhere?
Yeah.
So it took a lot of research, a lot of exploration. I would have to have a drink or two at each place to figure them out.
You had to have a lot of ballast. So, explain ballast.
Ballast is when you're going drinking or when you've been drinking, you need a little food in your stomach to soak up the alcohol,
mm-hmm.
so you don't capsize, as it were. You need a little ballast in the tank. And a couple of the writers that I really enjoy that write about bar going and the cocktail and bar world. Wayne Curtis is one of them, and Robert Simonson, and David Wondrich, and these are great guys, and they bandy about the term ballast and the importance of maintaining a little fuel in the tank.
Yeah, it's really funny. We've met lots of winemakers in our travels around the world, but one particular one in southern Spain, we're getting ready to drink his wine with lunch, and he decides he's going to have a beer.
Okay.
So he said for him, if he was the sales manager, so obviously he drank a fair amount of their wine, and he said what set him up, what his ballast was a beer.
A beer before he started.
So I had one too. And I think it worked for both of us.
Well, that's a good trick. I'm going to keep that in my back.
But that's
what's the science of that? I don't understand the science behind it.
I don't think there is any science behind it. But I picked one bar out as an example, just to give our listeners an idea of what's included, because this is such a rich book in terms of the number of places that it covers and they're spread out. So I picked one called Pete's. I can't imagine why I would have done that.
No, totally at random.
Absolutely at random. But you tell the story of Pete's making it through the Prohibition era. Explain how they were able to do that.
Yeah, so many of the bars in New York had had little tricks and scams to get through Prohibition, although for many of them it wasn't needed anyway because half of their customers were cops and politicians. But Pete's was a beauty. It's on 18th Street and Irving Place in New York, not far from Union Square Park.
Uh-huh.
And it's a good old time 1880 something bar, or 1864 is when it opened. A beautiful old building, and they have a large front bar room and a smaller back dining room. And during Prohibition, they closed off the door to the front bar room, and they put a sign out front that said florist. They took down their sign that said tavern, and they put up their sign that said florist. And they put heavy curtains in all the windows of the front bar room and put flowers, I assume fake flowers, in the window, in all the windows. And then, their front room was decked out as a florist with curtains that you couldn't see into the front room with. And their back room was the former dining room was set up as a florist shop with a counter and a refrigerator to the left that was full of flowers. And that refrigerator, if you went into it, you could walk to the back of it and go through a secret door that then led on to the bar room in the front of Pete, where the action actually was.
Uh-huh.
And they did that for about 13 years, and it worked.
And the famous author, O. Henry, apparently wrote a story there?
That's right. They say he wrote the story Gift of the Magi there, sitting at what they now call the O. Henry booth, which is to the right as you walk in. It's the second booth in, I think, as you walk in.
Yeah, I know. I know the Gift of the Magi.
This man did not miss out much in terms of his research.
Yeah, you really did a lot of work, didn't you?
But I like the bar where it's named after somebody's cat.
Oh yeah, Mona's.
Mona's.
Yeah. Yeah, the first owner named the bar after his cat, and the second owner liked that name, so he kept it.
Not the cat, though.
No, I don't think that cat's around anymore. That was in the 80s when the bar opened up.
Uh-huh.
But it's a lovely East Village dive bar in Manhattan.
Okay, and then I found another one here. One of my mother's favorite phrases was the pot calling the kettle black.
Right. Yeah, right.
And this one's called the kettle black, but the kettle black is famous for something else.
Yeah, the kettle black is it's a corner tavern down in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, which is a neighborhood a lot of folks don't get to or think of very often. It's rather out of the way. But the kettle black is known for its chicken wings, and it was named the best chicken wings in America by Food and Wine magazine a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they have
8 or 9 different varieties, just some really goofy ones. Grandpa Nunzio's wings are one of their most famous recipes, and that's being a very Italian neighborhood. That's a pretty good name for some wings down there.
This brings me to an interesting point which we talked about before we came on the air, and that is, there must be there was a risk for the black kettle that, in fact, it became so famous that it spoiled it for all the locals. And I have a feeling that you must have considered the risk of revealing all your favorites so that they would become crowded by people that you really didn't want to meet.
That would be giving me an awful lot of credit. That would be nice if the book got around that much, but we shall see. There was a fellow who wrote one of the blurbs for my book. His name is Tim Kreider. He's a New York Times occasional contributor and a fellow who loves to drink. And he was grateful, and he said so when he wrote a little nice note for the back of the book. He was grateful that I didn't mention his favorite place.
Uh-huh.
So there are some that went unmentioned out of however many thousand bars there are in New York. I only mentioned about 50 of them.
Well, now, what were your criteria? How did you select these?
Well, some of them I just knew would make the book. When they said they wanted 50 bars, I could have come up with 15 that I was sure would go in. Basically, they're bars that people love. They can be dive. Are we there now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. They can be dive bars. They can be new bars. They can be old bars. They can be fancy bars. But they have to be beloved by New Yorkers. That was the main criterion, generally speaking, was that they were beloved by New Yorkers. And there are a lot of ways to define that. It has to feel good, and it has to have a good regular crowd, and it helps if there's good music and just a good general feel and a feeling of good cheer in a place, whether it's a dive or a fancy place. And that brings us to a point called a German concept called Gemütlichkeit.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a feeling of cheerful well-being that you get, particularly at an especially good bar.
Now, you get a little bit of both the sinister and the amusing. For example, here's one called The Keep. And the keep is famous for being inhabited by the Bonino crime family.
yeah. There are so many good stories in these bars.
But then you go on, notice the smiling stuffed hyena high on the brick wall to the left of the bar. That is a very special guy. Stephanie explains, I love Hannibal, our male hyena, who oddly lived a long life and died of natural causes before he was taxidermied.
So she says.
That's what she says anyway, right? So
yeah.
So it wasn't named after Hannibal Lecter after all.
I suppose not.
We'll make it.
You know, I forgot to check if Bubblemans was in here.
Well, there we go. Yeah, Hannibal was, are you there?
I forgot to check if Bemelman's is in here. No?
Oh, Bemelman's. No, it's not, but if I were to do a second volume, I think I'd put Bemelman's in. I love that place. I just didn't have enough.
That would be probably one of the first ones I'd think of, because it has such a history.
Oh, it's a beautiful place too. I love the walls.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
I have the feeling there's a book two here somewhere.
I was going to ask you what you do for the book number two here, because you started this, and it's going to really attract a lot of attention, and people start going out drinking and looking around and seeing, you know, how this would fit in with the concept, right?
Yeah, I would think so. You know, some of the people that have read the book have already thought about the concept and have given me some suggestions, as you did just now with Bemelman's,
uh-huh,
of places that would be good for follow-ups if there were a book too. Now, if whether or not there will be, I don't know. We'll see how this one goes first.
Right.
Let me tell you a story and see if this is stimulating for you. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Prince Charles, the Duke of Windsor, Prince of Wales.
Prince of Wales.
Attended my university for a short time. He did not graduate. Rumors is that he wasn't a particularly good student, but it was reported that he had become a member of a group called the King Street Runners. And King Street in the city of Cambridge is a street with about 12 pubs on it. It's not a very long street. And there is this club called the King Street Runners, and you become a member of the King Street Runners if you can drink and retain a pint of beer in each one of those pubs. and the story that I read it in the Geelong newspaper, they were reporting that this is the kind of thing that Prince Charles would get up to when he was there. But no one in Australia seemed to think that it was a particularly noble or difficult thing to do, to drink a pint of beer in all 12 pubs on the street. What they failed to publish was that you had to drink and retain all 12.
Retaining part.
And the membership tie that you got when you were finished could contain no embroidery, or it could be an embroidered blue pea or an embroidered gold pea. See if you can guess.
I get it.
And the worst part about it was, if you wanted to continue on to try to win, you had to add one. So if you took a pee along the way, you had to drink another pint.
Another pint. Oh, good God.
Yeah, that's some place you could explore. Try doing this in Australia, where they really like to drink.
The Australian drinking audience was not particularly impressed until I pointed out in a letter to the editor what the real story was.
Yeah. The first thought that comes to mind is, gosh, was there a time limit in which you had to do this?
There is a time limit. It's called, how long can you hold on?
Yeah. How quickly can you drink, and how quickly does it get metabolized?
Oh, wow.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I did not attempt it. I don't have a large enough frame to be successful.
Well, you see,
I don't have a large enough stomach.
Yeah, you seem though to have a future cut out for you, John. I mean, you could do a tapas crawl and in Spain. You could go to, that's a test too. And you have all your ballast built in there, right?
I think it should be drink as I have known and loved.
Well, you know what we're getting at is we want you to be our new best friend.
And write other books to keep us amused.
And let us come with you on your explorations, too.
I would love to have you as research
assistants, right. That sounds great.
Well, listen,
I couldn't have done it without my research.
Listen, wait, John, pay your Verizon bill.
Or I
should pay mine. Thank you so much for joining us. Where are you going tonight?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going down to the neighborhood where I work, a 10 bar in Red Hook, Brooklyn.
It's about a mile and a half south of where
I live.
Yeah, I read your story of that particular bar.
Oh, there's a couple of wonderful bars down there. My wife and I are celebrating our anniversary this weekend. It's number 18 for
that's
us.
That's good.
Yeah, we're doing all right. Yeah. And we're going to go down to Red Hook. We'll probably stop by a place called The Good Fork. That's a nice restaurant with a nice little bar and a backyard. It's a beautiful day here in New York. And we might sit outside and have a cocktail and then go someplace for dinner after that. And then we have a show at Pioneer Works, a venue in Red Hook.
Congratulations on the 18th to you and your spouse.
Thank you.
Did you see, by the way, that Brooklyn had a James Beard winner?
Oh, yeah. Where was that?
I'm trying to remember.
It was Missy Robbins.
Missy Robbins. Who was best pasta?
I think it's called Lila or something like that.
It's called Lilia, I think.
Lilia.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, so she's a great chef. Yeah. So we've known her for a long time. So anyhow, okay, well, we'll let you go off to celebrate your anniversary. Ours is coming up, I think, June 22nd, which would be number 45.
Oh, you're doing all right, too.
I guess so. Have fun tonight, John.
John Thibault, thank you for your contribution to the world of imbibing.
Yeah, and stay in touch. Stay in touch.
You are so welcome. It's been my pleasure, and thank you so much for the chance to talk about it.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's all for us from On the Menu Radio for another week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place. Until then,
bye-bye.